there's moonbeams in your elbows, and there's rivers in your hair. And I wanna see you forever, babe, forever. Don't take me back in time now, but there's nothing for me there. Welcome to this week's episode of On the Wing Podcast, presented by Purina Pro Plan. I've got Travis Frank. You've already heard his voice, host of The Flush television show on Outdoor Channel and The Flush podcast, wherever you get your podcasts, back for our annual calibration on the season ahead and serving as my co-host. Punching his frequent podcasting card is Jared Wicklund, Director of Communications for Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever. Fellas, thank you very much for joining. You came over to this side of town this time.
Any excuse that we can just get together and talk about hunting and fishing, I'm all for it. So I'm grateful for the opportunity, as always, to come back in and be on your podcast. And you guys are on our podcast, and we kind of do this a couple times a year. I actually was at Jared's doing one of, was it last fall? Or we did the pheasant forecast for ours.
The pea podcast.
Yes.
Jared? I was misinterpreting. Like you had a closet podcast from your deck.
Yeah.
Outside.
Yep. Well, and he lives. Yep. Okay, so there is not, and I don't know if this is even, I should even be talking about this, but there's nothing more free feeling than peeing in the wild.
Yeah. I wasn't sure if I was going to get fired after that podcast aired or not, but I'm still here, and apparently everybody liked it because I got a lot of text messages on it.
So. Did you really?
So yeah, it's all good.
Jared's like, yeah, go for it, because I had to go, and yeah. I was like,
and just so you deck. Guys know, nothing has changed on that side of things. So,
I didn't kill any plants underneath your deck?
Oh, they were already toasted before
okay.
you got there. So,
well, I appreciate the opportunity to do that because it does. It's yeah. free feeling to be able to go in the great outdoors.
I was thinking about you this morning when I was outside there on the deck.
So, do you do it regularly now too?
Yeah, every morning, probably afternoon. I don't know.
I would do the same if I didn't have neighbors.
Water conservation. So.
It is, for okay. sure.
You guys took a left turn on me right out of the gate.
It's okay.
So anyway, it's good to be here. And I went into your restroom before we started this conversation. Yes. Not out in the great outdoors.
Yeah, I don't even know where to take that. If you would be the first person to pee in an office at Pheasants Forever. Well.
Thanks for having us on, though. I'm happy to be here. Anytime I can get together. Well, I see you just about every day, and we do a bunch of work together on awesome topics, whether it be public lands or habitat or anything in between, the news cycle. And Travis, you and I have spent a lot of time hunting together. Mm-hmm. Honestly, some of the best hunts I've had in the past few years, just pretty epic stuff, have come from the Flush, and I'm sure we'll get into it on the show.
So I was thinking from around some statistics. This is the 14th year of the Flush. Is that right?
It's one thing that I, for some reason, can't.
It's the 13th or 14th.
I think it's yeah. 14th year of the Flush, and it's the... let me see. It's the 20th year, I think, of our partnership with Ron Scherer Productions around television show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it used to be Pheasants Forever Television.
Pheasants Forever Television mm-hmm. in 2005, I'm pretty sure, was the very first iteration of this. Yep. And it was on Versus Channel.
Versus Network.
Versus Network. Yep. And then that became NBC Sports.
Yep.
And then we changed names. And it went to
I think originally it was on ESPN2. I'm pretty sure it was on ESPN2.
Pheasants Forever Television?
Yeah.
Oh, was it really?
And then it went Versus. And then, because networks, I feel like networks and things have been changing all the time. But currently today it's on the Outdoor Channel
yep.
in America and then Wild TV.
Yep.
So.
And it's repackaged
yep.
as Rooster Tales.
Yep.
And that is on.
Sportsman's Channel. And FanDuel Sports Networks across the Midwest. And the reason we do that is because ultimately we're trying to reach as many bird hunters as possible. Mm-hmm. The way that people have television today, which packages they have. Some might get the Outdoor Channel, some might get Sportsman Channel. We want to make sure that if they don't have one, they can still catch the action and the messaging still remains the same. So,
but for clarity, like the season that we're going to preview here,
yeah,
the only place to watch that this year is on Outdoor Channel. And then last year's show, the season of 2024, that was on Outdoor Channel. That's what gets repackaged and put on Sportsman's Channel under the banner and FanDuel under the banner of Rooster Tails.
Correct.
Right? Okay.
And and online too, right?
Yeah. So how the network, how our contract works with the network is that we cannot stream the episode until the entire season runs its course.
Yep.
So starting July all the way through December is our new season of shows on the Outdoor Channel, and then in January we can stream the show in its entirety on our YouTube channel, and that gives people, the cord cutters, an opportunity to watch.
This probably will not shock you, but the amount of emails I get, like no contact us form on our website, that come in like, hey, where can I watch this, or when is the next season of The Flush going to be posted online? I get a lot of those. So
it is a lot. Yeah. So we get it regularly too. I've answered it hundreds of times. That's just how the contract works. Some people want it now, and I say, you can't have it now. Unfortunately, in a time where we have everything right now at our fingertips,
yep,
you can get you can get the Outdoor Channel, and so then you can watch every episode as it airs with everybody else. But until the whole season runs its course, we cannot stream it. And so that's just the way it is for right now.
So we're going to talk through some of the episodes, but a little bit more on the logistics of how to watch it. Mm-hmm. Outdoor Channel is the destination. There's 13 episodes. They start July, as you mentioned. They go third and fourth quarter of the calendar year, third quarter. And then they rebroadcast the exact same 13 shows.
Correct.
For the fourth quarter. So you have two opportunities to watch them before they hit your favorite streaming service,
yep,
right?
Yep.
And within that, there are five different times during the week you can watch them on Outdoor Channel. So got them in front of me. Mondays, these are all times Eastern. Mondays at 2:30 p.m., Tuesdays at 12:30 p.m., Thursdays at 8:30 a.m., then this is probably your signature spot, would be my guess.
The Saturdays,
12:30 p.m. Eastern, which means that that's 11:30 a.m. Central.
At Bob's house.
At my house. So it's like I get done with radio, I wake up from my nap, and then flip on The Flush.
You nap every time after the show's over?
No, not every time, especially during hunting season.
Right.
There's no time to nap, but spring, winter, there might be a nap involved.
Yeah. I feel like now that July hits, and you mentioned the quarters, the way networks work is they run things by quarters. So July, August, September, that's a quarter. October, November, December, that's fourth quarter. And so they run the whole season, they repeat it again, and then we're off the air for a couple months, and then we do it again. And we do it again.
The one additional, I said there were a grand total of five times. The other one is for those early risers on Sunday morning, 6:30 a.m. Eastern. So you got Mondays, Tuesdays, Thursdays, Saturdays, Sundays, and can even DVR it, right?
I was going to say, DVR is still a thing, right? Most people,
I don't know.
Just,
I don't do it. But,
I know. They I get a lot of messages saying, yep, DVR'd. Can't wait to watch it tonight. So once that first one airs, then you can go home and watch it at your leisure anytime at all.
Do you know how many shows you've been on of The Flush or Pheasants Forever Television?
I think three.
Three?
Two or three. They were both in, well, I think it was two. They were both in Iowa, and they were both epic.
They really were.
The amount of birds we had on those trips. One was in western Iowa. We focused on a partnership between the chapter, DNR, and landowners.
That was the Les Hills one, right?
Yep. Some of the IHAP ground that's enrolled over there, which was all great. And then the other one was in northern Iowa. It was the dream hunt that we auctioned off.
Yeah.
Yep, with the flush and all that money coming back to wildlife habitat conservation. And we just got a couple awesome landowners down there, Josh Diven, our state coordinator. Rich Berkland, who is another one, who, by the way, we're putting on an awesome farm tour with him in August. So if you're in Northern Iowa and you want to know, like, what's the recipe for making a huge bird population, feel free to reach out to Pheasants Forever and ask for Jared, and I can get you more info on it.
Will there be an opportunity to pee off his deck as part of that farm tour? I know you guys brought it here, so I thought I would keep it.
He's got a much larger acres than I do, so you can get away from the crowd if you need to. But
I asked the DNR law enforcement one time. I was like, "Is it illegal to pee off a boat?"
What was the answer?
He goes, "I mean, if you're exposing yourself and there's other people around." I said, "No, is it illegal to pee in the lake?"
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, "We just can't enforce it. Because if you jump it in, I have no idea if you are or you're not." It's like, I know, but would it be illegal? And he couldn't give me a straight answer. I never got a straight answer out of him. So I don't know. No, I mean, everybody listening to this podcast, if you hunt, I'm guessing you probably have gone in the wild.
Yeah, you just find a tree.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
But a fishing boat, which I admit to have done too.
Yeah.
But, I mean, when you got to go, you got to go, and you're on a boat. Right. But, you know, I can see where there is some legal gray area.
That's where you take the wiffle ball bat with the end cut off approach.
That's your tool?
Yes.
I have not heard of that before.
Have not. Really? I learned early as a kid up in Canada, there was like, I thought it was like a fish bonk or something. I'm like, "Oh, what is this?" And they're like, be careful with that. Okay. So I learned about what it was. Anyways.
Oh, a hollowed out wiffle ball bag.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. Yep.
There you go. Back in college, I had friends that had flamingos, like those lawn ornaments flamingos. They cut the deck off, and it was a flabongo. So they would pour a beer in there, and then the way it would come down the neck of the flamingo, then they cut open the beak, it was a beer bong. And so if you've ever had a flabongo, it comes in fast.
It would be very bad to mix up the flamingo thinking that it was your on-boat urinal. Yes.
Do not go in. Don't do a flamingo in Jared's
Use
boat.
The wiffle bat! Use the wiffle bat!
There's too much going on there.
But no, plenty of room on Rich's farm if you need to get out and do that.
Back to Rich's.
But no, honestly, though, if you're in northern Iowa, southern Minnesota, and you want to learn how to make pheasants, his property is
I
incredible.
Swear, listen, we have they
we
have
just lost
they,
everybody.
They
we
have waters them. In front of them. This is not
Kirkland.
This is
signature.
Not a Greenbelt premium commercial. Oh, good. I have a Snapple.
And if you need other, if you want to learn how to raise pheasants, you go to Rich's. If you want to learn about how to go in the wild, you go to Jared's.
Yes.
Classes are going to be mid-August to early September.
They're free, by the way. I don't even charge for
them. Look for the hollowed-out wiffle bat in this year's banquet package fit with a Pheasants Forever logo. And
brought to you by Jared's
The
kids.
Autographed version will be on fundraising at National Pheasant Fest.
There we go.
Ho! I'm going to make a transition now. thanks to, I'm sure Purina's thrilled to be this transition, but proud to recognize Purina.
How did we get here?
I don't know. You guys, right out of the gates.
Right out of the beginning.
Proud to recognize Purina Pro Plan as the national dog food sponsor of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever's A Wildlife Habitat Mission, and the presenting sponsor of On the Wing Podcast. My pups all eat Purina Pro Plan, not just because Purina supports wildlife habitat conservation through our organization, which is obviously incredibly important to me. But what's even more important is that Purina Pro Plan is a team of the world's best scientists and nutritionists behind their dog food. It was designed for the working bird dog like yours and like mine. You can learn more at ProPlanSport.com. Purina Pro Plan, nutrition that performs. All right, I'm going to read some of your words back to you.
Uh-oh, that's always scary.
You submitted an article for the upcoming Super issue. of the Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever's journals. It's the only issue of the year that we do as a joint publication. And Travis, you supplied an article previewing the flush this year. And some of your words, here we go. It's often hard to sum up a hunting season in just a couple of words. But this year, family time comes to mind when I think about the episodes we documented for our new season of The Flush. I'm not talking about a 90s sitcom-like depiction of family time. I'm talking about real, raw, rugged moments spent in the field hunting with our families and yours. So put that a little bit more into it. Well, let me first, what's your favorite 90s sitcom?
Oh, my goodness. So, I mean, we think back to 90s sitcoms.
What Married with Children. You're the totally Al Bundy.
Well, I mean, I feel like, oh, gosh. What was the one where they were everywhere you look, everywhere?
Family, is that Family Matter?
Family Matter. No. No.
I was a Seinfeld guy.
Yeah, Seinfeld is classic.
Me too.
I loved,
watched it every night almost.
Seinfeld, I mean, and then you had Friends. Mm-hmm. What was the younger version of that, though, would have been?
The younger version of Friends?
Not younger version of that, but early 90s would have been Full House.
Full House.
Yes, I feel like every kid in the 90s watched Full House. But yeah, I think Seinfeld, I think I watched Cheers with my parents.
Who wouldn't watch Cliff Clavin?
Baywatch? You remember
you that took was another 90s? Lecture.
I remember it.
You remember, Jerry, did you watch Baywatch?
All right, I'll get us back on track. Tell us about family. Family sitcom theme for The Flush this year.
I'll go back a year prior to that. The previous season, I felt like highs and lows. It's the first time I've ever really thought at a big glance about the whole season. And that year, 2 years ago, we had a lot of highs and lows. Mm-hmm. I mean, some incredible moments in the field and then some terrible moments. Mm-hmm. Terrible. And so
we lost a bird dog.
Yeah, in a hot spring out west that lasted seconds. I mean, it was awful. Mm-hmm. And some of that stuff you don't even want to produce. But the reality is it happened, and that's the stuff that happens. We all experience highs and lows out there in the field, and we try to show that. We try to, I mean, you guys have seen it. We're not scripting anything. You can't. It's wild birds, and most of it's public land, and weather plays a huge factor in everything. So we just try to tell the story as real and true as possible. And so the highs and lows that come with it really summed up last season, two seasons ago. This current one, when I think about it, family time is what really stood with it or stuck out to me because, one, I took my entire family, all four of my kids, my wife, and my mom, to North Dakota, to one of my all-time favorite places, because the year prior, I took my son on his first pheasant hunt.
And to the same place?
Yeah, similar area. Okay. We took our Ice Castle fish house, my son and I, and we camped out on the prairie. Mm-hmm. And so this time...
Let people know the span of ages of your kids, too, because that's an important component.
Yeah, so currently they're 11, 9, 7, and 3. And so last year at the time we took them hunting, it was 10, 8, 6, and 2. Mm-hmm. And so my mom always has been asking me questions about what it's like out there. And she listens to our podcast and watch the shows we produce. And so I said, Mom, you want to come with too? Because when they watched me hunt with my son out there on that show, they just were all like, I want to go. I want to go. Can we go this year? Can we go? So I said, yeah, let's do it. We're going to take the whole family. And so it was a different experience than I've ever experienced. I mean, trying to pack for really myself, but then all four kids, mm-hmm. my wife and my mom and the camera. operator and have everything that we need. And would you believe that after the first walk, I had enough gloves for everybody, I had the right boots, I had layers for everybody, and I forgot the snacks, Bob. I forgot the snacks, and that's major meltdown. When
that's
you're
a key downfall right there.
Oh,
as a girl dad myself.
Every time I bring my kids anywhere out there, hunting, fishing, snacks are a part of it. So the fact that I forgot that, I mean, it's just, I wasn't shooting, but I had my two-year-old in a backpack that I carried her. And I'm, you know, running Daisy. But then both my boys are shooting and my wife are on the gun. My mom is watching. She's holding hands with my daughter. And they're picking wildflowers at the same time. There's just a lot going on out there. But both my boys got a bird. And my wife got a bird. And that's really going to be something that I'll always remember from it. But there's part of that experience out there that's beyond just harvesting a bird. And for me, the migration is a powerful thing. And I think for most people it is too. If you look at Planet Earth and some of these documentaries that have been out for decades, the migration is just a powerful part of a lot of these features, these Nat Geo things. So here in central Minnesota, you see some flocks of geese fly over, but you don't see and hear the true power of the migration unless you're actually out where it's happening. So I was hoping, timing it the last week of October, that we would be a part of that. And also, I wanted them to see a moose. And I am spoiling part of this story, but I found a roost of snow geese on the shoreline of some public land. We hunted all public land out there, which made it even harder. But also a blessing, too, because they get to see just how real and hard it is to get close to a wild bird and to take a shot and make the shot. So anyway, the migration lifts up and thousands of geese and everyone, even my two-year-old who doesn't stop talking in my ear in my backpack, she was just in awe of it, you know, the power. So they got to experience that. And literally as we're watching it, my daughter looks over and she goes, "Dad, look at this." And she steps in this moose track in the soil because it's walking out into the water and its track sank down like 8-10 inches. So her whole foot fit in it. And as we're talking about this track, my son looks up on the horizon and there's Bullwinkle.
Oh, wow.
A big
That's
old
pretty
moose.
Cool.
It was. So everything really came together. They got to experience so much of what I love about the prairie and those wild places. But I wasn't the only one that took their kid hunting. Bill Shirk took his son out after his first pheasant. They went to South Dakota together. And that's a story that's airing this season, too. Scott Franzen brought his daughter out, Hannah the Hunter. He's got three daughters. And Hannah's the one that just always was interested in trying to take her first bird. So they were in western Minnesota, where Scott likes to go. And so we all brought our family into the hunting season this year, personally sharing our stories, which you mix a little bit of work in these experiences. It can be a little bit stressful, especially, you know, where I look at wanting to be present for my kids in that moment, because it's a pretty powerful thing to harvest your first bird, to be out in the field. And there's also the fact that I'm working with the videographer to make sure he has what he needs. And, you know, I don't want to take away from this personal experience with my kids. So being dad, being producer, and that's a balance that I've tried to work through there. But ultimately, I think we'll look back years from now and say, that was a pretty cool thing that we were able to do. Hopefully, based on the feedback that I received from our viewers after sharing the story of my son's first pheasant, when we were out there last year, it'll really resonate with a lot of people. And I heard from a lot of our viewers too that said that they showed their kids and their kids were then excited to go try too. And I think that's really our goal, is to make sure to remind people that you can bring your kids along really early. It might change the dynamic of a hunt a little bit, but it can be really rich in different ways.
I think one of the coolest parts about that is being a parent is that, like, it's raw and it's real, right? And, like, kids don't have – they have less of this perception, like, oh, there's a camera following me. like kids are going to say what they're going to say.
Yeah.
And I think that's what makes the show unique, especially when you have that perspective of a mm-hmm. of a youth, a child, you know, which I find pretty awesome. We did some turkey hunting this spring, and my daughter missed three times, but that I don't care about that. She was like, "Oh, Dad, you know, I'm sorry." And I'm like, "Don't worry about it. I can't shoot a turkey half the time anyways. I miss way more than that."
Yeah.
So, you know, getting that perspective and just her being out there, you know, and at the end of the season, like, "Dad, this is so cool. I want to do it again next year. And before then, we're going to go to the cabin and we're going to try to get a deer together," you know? And it's just like, mm-hmm. it melts your heart. Those are the types of moments, I think. That's why we do it.
Yeah, and you mentioned the kids say the darndest things, right? That was a 90s show. There you go. Well, that's the truth. I mean, there's so many times where we come out to hunt with people and film a story, and they're like, "Okay, what do you want me to say?" And I'm like, "Whatever you normally would say." There's nothing scripted here, but yet you point a camera at most adults. You guys can speak to this. When we point a camera at you, you kind of like, you choke up, or you think you start thinking about what you're going to say instead of just being you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I always try to say. Don't worry about the camera. You and I, don't talk to the camera. It's not even there. We're hunting together. We're doing this together, and we're trying to just be how we would be if the camera wasn't here at all.
What percentage of people absolutely freeze up and you're like, "Oh, I'm in trouble now"?
Probably a quarter.
Yeah.
One out of every four. And those are the ones that I really have to work with. And I really have to then talk with the videographer and say, "Why don't you just keep a little bit of a distance or just stay behind me?" And as I warm them up a little bit, then we can turn the camera over their direction. But sometimes people, it does make them nervous, and understandably so.
Mm-hmm. So would you see if these percentages resonate? So a quarter freeze up and you're like, "Oh, we're in trouble." 50% are just like, "Eh, they're okay."
Mm-hmm.
And then 20%, like, maybe even less, maybe it's like 10 or 15, like, "You got it."
Yep. Something like that. Maybe a quarter.
Another quarter have
got it. Yeah. And those are fun times. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'd say generally though, once the hunt begins and the dog does what it's not supposed to do and your attention is on the bird that just got away and they start, "Dang it," you know, whatever comes out, the camera picks that up. Yeah. You know, they're 300 yards away.
They loosen up a little bit.
They miss one. I miss one. Mm. They laugh at me. I laugh at me. It's really changes the dynamic, and pretty soon we're in the hunt together. We're in the experience together. Our cameramen are, for the most part, pretty seasoned, and so they've been out there enough to laugh alongside with everything, and we're all on this adventure together.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty soon they realize that. They also realize just how hard those cameramen work to really get everything, to get in position, busting, you know, grouse hunting. My goodness, Bob, how many times have we done that too, where camera's trying to follow, we're like, hold up, you know? It changes it a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
It really does. But if the camera doesn't see it, it never happened.
You know, you talked about, as you're talking about your family, and we discussed this last year too, you know, you're taking your son out on his first hunt and you're bringing the camera along.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that you spend a lot of time figuring, is this the right thing to do or not? Like, where's the line here? And I know you struggle with some of this. You know, so I'm curious about your thought process and where you are right now, because not only with your family, but here's something you love. And it's different the minute that there's somebody behind you with a camera capturing everything. You always got to be on, versus I just want to go on a bird hunt with my dog and just relax like the rest of the world. How do you process that?
It's a balance I don't know that I have figured out, Bob.
Does it really drive you crazy having the camera behind you every day?
It's not necessarily crazy. It just changes it a lot.
It is work.
It's work, yeah. We're telling stories about hunting. Everyone's like, "Oh, you get paid to go hunting." And while technically I'm out there hunting, my goal is always to come home with a TV show and the content needed to produce that. And so it changes the dynamic a little bit. I'm not going to complain about that one bit, because what a blessing it is to be able to go out with people like you and our listeners and our viewers into some of our most beautiful places in this world. But my wife and I talk about it. I'm like, honey, I just really want to go for a walk without anybody else to talk to. And I do it, well, maybe a couple of times throughout the whole hunting season where it's just me and the dog. Because with four kids at home, when I'm gone for a week, the last thing I feel good about is saying, all right, I'm going to go hunting now for the week. You know, and so I usually bring them with, and I love every part of that. And that's wonderful stuff. But as far as the work part of it and having a camera along, I just sometimes need to be able to go for a walk and not say a word and enjoy the beauty of watching a bird dog. Because sometimes I'm robbing my dog, too, of that experience because she's doing exactly what she is supposed to do, except for we got cameras and I know she's on a bird 240 yards that way and she's going to pin it, but I have to call her off of it because I can't maneuver the whole team over to what she's doing over there. And so she's constantly being pulled off of what is bred inside of her to do.
How old is Daisy now?
Five. Yeah. The other thing, too, and you touched on it a little bit here, is I really struggle with the whole social media component. I don't remember, and I think we've talked about this before, maybe on previous podcasts, I don't remember hunting or fishing with my dad or my grandpa or my uncles growing up, and every time something happened, we stopped, and they pointed a phone in my face and took pictures of it or video of it. And I feel like by doing so, I'm removing myself from the moment. And there's a balance of wanting to capture that, to record it, to remember it forever, because we have beautiful photos that we've hung up on our wall at home from my wife's first, you know, sharptail out in the prairie in the Missouri River. And
you took a photo of me with Esky. That is my most cherished photo, but I absolutely,
and I love that photo and I love capturing it and I love the photography side of it. I also wonder though how present or not present I am by taking myself out of that experience versus giving a big hug and just me and my daughter and my son celebrating that.
I think there's a fine balance there because I'm on the opposite end of the spectrum where like I know I'm not a great photo taker, and we've even had like internal sack lunch series that what we call in the office where people tune in like, hey, you want to learn about taking better photos in the field and doing those types of things, capturing those moments. I'm a little jealous of the pictures that you take, to be totally honest, because when I need a good picture for a story or something like that, you know I'm not afraid to pick up the phone and be like, oh, I saw one that Travis had last year, and I'll get a picture of that. But I wish for myself, I need to do a better job of – I mean, my daughter took some photos a couple weeks ago for Father's Day, and they were great. And I'm like, what did you do that I'm not? You know, they know how to work the iPhone and some of the settings on it. But
yeah, these things take amazing photos. I mean, that I know you guys have done – talks on that before too in podcasts, but you can capture a lot. I used to carry a DSLR everywhere, and now the quality that you can get off of an iPhone.
I totally get what you're saying though about like finding that balance there, but taking good photos and having those to look back on, I think, is just really important.
The thing that keeps me from deleting everything and just going completely off the social grid is the amount of people that reach out and say thank you for doing that or showing your wife out there in the field with you and your kids, because I did that too and my wife saw it and she goes, well, that's awesome, and she wanted to come out and see what it's like too. And so I think my goal whenever we produce a show is to really inspire people and educate them, and if we're inspiring them to get out there and experience what we love out there and inspiring kids and wives to come with husbands or husbands to come with wives or whatever it might be, that everybody can enjoy that together. They don't have to be an elite hunter to go with along. And I didn't carry a shotgun for most of that family hunt. And yet that was something special to have my daughter riding on my shoulders and for her to see it all and to touch that bird. And we did a tailgate lunch overlooking the prairie and the bluffs, and I brought a football and we threw that while grilling out there, and we cooked up the pheasant my son shot out there, and just them hopefully being able to years from now look back and remember some of that. Because I look back at growing up, you know, and I spent time with my grandpas. I was fortunate that both of them, one was a farmer that retired, one was a farmer that farmed until he couldn't anymore, and riding tractors with them, going fishing with them, going hunting, trapping with them. There was never a physical gift that I received from them that I'm like, oh, that was the best gift I ever got. You know, it wasn't like I received something of, you know, I opened up in a box at Christmas. It was the experiences that we shared together. And experiences and time, like our time is the most valuable gift that we ever get to give to our kids, our grandkids, our friends, our husbands, our wives. And, you know, I watch you and your wife are spending all these times together in great places. And I love it. I just love that you two enjoy that together. And I'm fortunate that my wife likes to come with and experience that too. And, you know, Jared, you talked about taking your daughter out turkey hunting. Those are the things that I think we really are going to remember a lot more than anything else.
Well, even thinking about this and with a backdrop of pheasants forever and quail forever, right? Putting down on the business mind here, I want to say thank you to you. Because one in our, you've heard us talk about a strategic plan. One of the major components of this strategic plan is growing our community, people that care about the uplands, you know, and we try to mobilize folks to speak up for public lands or speak up for a farm bill. Well, if they don't have any connection, they're not going to speak up,
right?
So you talked about trying to inspire people through television, through these stories. And you're doing that. The flush is a huge component for us of that, building the community. But that doesn't come without sacrifices, personal sacrifices that you're making to tell, you know, reveal your own hunting time with just you and your family, and putting it on camera for the whole world to see, the good, the bad, the ugly, the indifferent, right? But with the hope that somebody else, hopefully thousands upon hundreds of thousands of others, see this and say, I want to have these same experiences. And then they want to take other people, and they, hopefully it's on great habitat. Mm-hmm. And some of that habitat's on public land. Some of it habitat is maybe CRP, right? And if they have those experiences in great places, they can speak to what our mission is.
Right.
And if we don't inspire people, that audience continues to shrink and shrink and shrink, and then nobody cares anymore.
And I've been fortunate to speak at quite a few of our Pheasants Forever banquets across the Midwest, and a message that continues to come up that I share during it, and I've also mentioned it maybe on this podcast and ours, is that there's going to come a day when our kids are the ones that have to make the decisions for wild places and wild animals. And if they don't know anything about it, why should we expect them to care? Mm-hmm. Right. And the only way to know something about it is to be out there with them. And I really think that hunting is the best way to understand everything that wild animals need, because without the right habitat and without being put in that position, you don't really grasp it. Mm-hmm. You can drive by it, you can look at it, but until you're standing in it, you just don't know. And I think everybody listening right now can nod their head and say, yeah, totally. And because I'm a hunter, I really get the whole ecosystem. I really get the whole picture, the big picture, other than just a little snippet driving by.
Yeah. I'm going to take us in a slightly different direction.
Please.
You're talking about Rosie. I'm sorry, Daisy.
Yeah.
Rosie Daisy. Daisy.
She doesn't care.
Your poinsettia.
Yeah.
New as a flower. All right. So Daisy is 5 now. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about probably the most stressful year you've ever had hosting the flush.
Puppy season.
Was the first year that you had a bird dog of your own.
Yeah.
And I'm also going to assume that now that you have a dog that you trust and depend on, it's actually probably making even better television, because you don't have to worry about the pup, and you know when your pup is putting you on birds, as opposed to like the previous, before your own dog, you were depending on other people to read the dogs and you were trying to read other dogs. But my guess is you're hitting the salad days of hosting Outdoors Upland Television because of the age of your dog. Is my theory accurate or inaccurate?
I am forever grateful and amazed at that dog. She has taken me, and I've taken her, to some pretty cool places, but she just flat out has a drive to find the birds, and she finds them. And I trust her now, like you said. And so sometimes the cameraman doesn't like how far she goes out to find them. Occasionally, the way she hunts doesn't necessarily, if we're on a small, tiny little area, and there's a line of people, you know, like she just is going to go find the birds. I do trust her, though, that she will hold them. And it might be 10 minutes before we get there. It might be 15, and she's going to be standing there, and the bird's going to be there when we get there. So that's the beauty of it. But, yeah, it was definitely a night and day difference from when I started hunting her, when she was just this loose cannon out there running wild. And that was very, very, very stressful to try to produce TV with a dog like that. But once everything clicked, it just changed everything. I've 100% confidence taking her and putting her down in the woods, on the prairie, in the mountains, and she will find birds. And she's proven it again and again. But I think a lot of that comes down to, and you've interviewed so many dog trainers, Bob, and people that we both respect, wild birds. Man, do they make a dog. And she's been fortunate to hunt a lot of them for different landscapes, and they just know. Isn't that amazing how they...
That was going to be my next question. Like, you know, you look at the list of episodes this year, and... You know, pheasants to sharptails to rough grouse to, you know, blue grouse.
Right out of the gate, our first hunt was Wyoming, and we were hunting blue grouse up in the mountains, 10,000 feet up, and she knew what a blue grouse was very quickly.
Like the very first encounter she knew?
Locked on point. Yep, instantly, frozen. And sometimes you wonder what the smell is. Why don't they stop on every single bird? Why is it that a meadowlark is no big deal? They just run right through them and meadowlarks get up, or other songbirds. Why is it that they know instantly there's something different about you and I am going to freeze?
So is there any bird that it wouldn't be considered a game bird that she points, or anything? Because I have had dogs that point meadowlarks.
And turkeys, but I guess turkeys.
Yeah, turkeys, I guess they're gallinaceous, right? So it'd be similar. But you're right. Like, I've had every single one of my dogs points turtles.
Turtles,
yeah.
I don't know about that.
The turtles, box turtles in the Fort Pierre grasslands, to snapping turtles, laying eggs in July, to painted turtle. My dogs point turtles.
She'll bark at hare.
Really?
Yeah. So whether it's a rabbit or a deer or something with hair, she'll all of a sudden I hear a bark and I'm like, what the heck? And I'm like, oh, she found a rabbit. But why? I don't know. That's a German part of her. That's what I've been told. That's her. That's the German in her.
Yeah.
No, it's amazing how quickly a bird dog just, you know, they can smell a Hungarian partridge if they're never once in their life smelling it and know that they need to freeze, or there's something about this that's our goal out here. I love watching it.
A couple years ago, I had, this was the coolest experience of my hunting life, but I had Jackson, my 13-year-old English pointer, now locked up on a great horned owl behind our house in the prairie. Wow. Yeah, honestly, went back out there with like oven mitts and grass. It had a broken wing and took it down to the Raptor Center, but it was just cool getting that close to a bird that size.
Yeah, I suppose now that I think about it, I would say probably a couple of hawks have gotten up off of points, and probably a couple of other owls, smaller ones. I don't know if I've seen a great horned owl on point yet, but she certainly finds anything that's alive out there.
any terrain that has caused her to kind of take a little time to get used to it?
Well, I did learn really quickly in Wyoming the rocky terrain out there. Mm. My dog still, even though she's five, she comes out after a long road trip. She is like revved up.
Mm.
Her motor, I mean, you can just, I let her out of the box and she's standing there ready for me to tap her on the head and say, hi. That's her command to hunt. It's like, you know, I mean, she's seriously revving her engine, and I release her, and it is so obnoxious how fast she runs, and it really aggravates me because she's not hunting right. She's going too fast.
Huh.
She's overrunning her nose.
Has she been like that her whole life?
Her whole dang life. Mm. And I have dropped her off before, miles before the starting
just
gate,
to get her to
trying
slow
to
down.
Get her to slow down. Uh-huh. And so this is a prime example. It's a 20-hour drive from here to where we hunted in Wyoming, and she's in the kennel. The whole time she knows something awesome is about to happen, and she's revved up. Well, she came out of the box, and she's flying through the mountains and the rocks, and she tore her pads so hard that first half day, the first morning. And we had 3 days up there in the mountains. We camped out there on top of the mountains in tents, and she had no pads left.
Oh, my gosh.
I know. So when the hunt was over, I'd call her, and she wouldn't even come to me. I had to go pick her up and carry her and set her in the kennel. But the second she knew we were hunting again, she would just go and hunt.
Hmm.
And so, yeah, the terrain there really, really took it out of her. And again, it goes down to, I'm like, slow down, girl.
Yeah.
I can't take that out of her, and I'm still... You know, I've had people say, yeah, just run her 10 miles before. Yeah. But it's always the 10-mile mark. I look at the GPS. All right, at 10 miles, we got her in her prime for the rest of this week.
Huh.
Just got to get that out of her at first. And it's so annoying. It is so annoying. But then she hunts at this steady pace. Like, we were in Oklahoma hunting bobwhites, 30 degrees, an inch and a half of snow on the ground. Perfection. January. And she would go over 30 miles each day that she ran.
Mm.
But she had just a steady pace to her that she never went above or beyond. It was just, this was her pace. And she could do it from sunrise to dark every day. And it just, the temperature was right. She'd come back, we'd give her water, and she just would go and go and go. And it was like that soft snow was perfect on her paws. And everything about it was just ideal for her to just hunt. And she was in heaven, and I was too, watching her.
Does she have a favorite bird?
I feel like she's really, and maybe because this is my favorite bird, is the ruffed grouse.
Okay.
She's really gotten pretty good at them. I have not still. Because even though they might be on point there, you guys know, you love ruffed grouse like uh-huh. I do. That hitting one is just...
So is she a grouse hunter that holds her nose up high, or is she scenting the ground? Do you know?
So, yeah. When I get to her point, if she, you know, tails up and her face is straight down and it's pointing, she's looking, she's not going to move, that bird is right there.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you when we're walking up, it's in front of her.
Uh-huh.
If her head is up, she's standing there, and she'll, like, look, yeah. her eyes will look over at us when we're walking. She'll look over, and every once in a while, her head will slowly move. Don't worry, guys. The bird walked up ahead.
Mm-hmm.
I'll release her, and she'll relocate. So you can always tell if the bird is there, or if she's like, guys, there's one here. I'm just telling you, there's one here. I don't exactly know for sure where it is yet, but I'm not going to go a little bit. I'm not going to take a step because I don't want to be the one to risk flushing this thing. And I love the heck out of her for that, because she knows it's there. She's not going to bump it.
At 5 years old.
Oh, yeah.
That bird dog, like that tell, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Everybody knows their bird dog
better
their
dog.
Than somebody. Yes.
Yeah.
Every bird dog has a tell about, like, where the bird's at, what they're doing. So,
and I love taking...
That's pretty cool.
I love taking people with that aren't familiar with it and experiencing it. And they'll walk by, like, let's say a woodcock. When you're in the woods and I go, oh gosh, I already know what's happening here. There's a woodcock right in front of her. And I say, okay. And we know the plan. I'm like, give her some space and then walk right past her. Okay, so they walk in and they walk right past her and they keep going and they're like, nothing. And I go, turn around,
right, yeah,
and now walk right towards her. You know, they're 20 feet past her already. And I'm like, it is there. And they're like, it's not here. Like, just keep walking a little bit around her in front of her. And when that bird gets up, just that whole rush that comes with it. But they don't know. And I can tell you based on her stance. Mm-hmm. I'm like, no, I'm telling you, there is one right there in front of you. And then it gets up and they're just like, oh, that is a beautiful thing. How do you know? And, you know, that just comes with the repetition, I think, yeah, the time spent together.
Well, it also means you have a special dog. Maybe not the woodcock component, but the grouse, the differentiation between I've got it.
Yeah.
Versus.
And she does that in the field, too, with pheasants. You know, if the head's up, I say there's one in front of her. Mm-hmm. It ran up ahead. Mm. I'll release her. But the fact that she's not going to go up and risk flushing it, that's a key part of it, too. Mm-hmm. Because if, you know, with her speed out there running, a lot of those pointing breeds, yours too, Bob, and yours too, Jared. You know, if that dog's out there at 80 yards or 120 yards or 200 yards, doesn't matter. If they flush it, you know, it's not within shooting range. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's really cool, and I get excited now just thinking back to it, because I haven't ran in a field with her since before the birds went on the nest. Mm. And I'm excited to get back out there again. I think, you know, this time of the year in July, and Bob, you and I have talked about this before, after the 4th of July, something changes in us, mm-hmm, and other hunters too. We start to see the interest level increase in our followers and listeners and viewers too, and the interactions are increasing. People are thinking hunting season again,
yep,
starting after the 4th of July, because it comes fast. It's hard to believe that we're at this point in the summer.
Right after, you know, you get into July and then into August, you know, July around here is when sort of the rough grouse, the drumming counts and stuff come out. So mm-hmm, I'm just sitting at my computer after that time, just hitting the refresh button, and I'm doing it all yeah day long. Like, hey, August roadside's the same way. Like, mm-hmm, everybody wants to know. It's not like, it's not the whole picture, but it gives you a very good glean into, like, this season's going to produce, and the spots that, you know, mean the most to me and the places that I like to go, you know, you're just focusing really hard on what that looks like and what color it is. Cause if it's dark brown on the Minnesota prospects map,
I don't know about you guys, but my weather app has a lot of my favorite hunting locations on it. Yep. And I'm checking it every day to see
if it's going to pour or not.
During the hatch.
Yep.
I'm looking back, you know, mm-hmm, at what's happened out there. I'm talking with friends in the area. I want to know what those little guys are up to. Mm-hmm. I can't get it out of my blood. I can't stop thinking about it. And granted, we live in this bubble, this bird hunting bubble of ours. But my forecast is some of my favorite places across the Midwest, and I'm checking it every day during the hatch to find out if the birds are getting rained on. How are they doing up there?
Yeah.
I wonder if they think about me too.
they're thinking about Daisy for sure.
They are, yeah, totally. Yeah. Yep. You know, we talked about the family side of it, mm-hmm, with our personal families, but there's so many other families, mm, that are out there that we do stories with. And so as I wrote that article, I was thinking about some of the other, not technically families, but bird hunting families. You know, we spent time in the field with buddies that they've transformed their own bird camp. Like, there was this church in northern Minnesota that this guy, he was looking for a place to make a hunting camp.
Hmm.
And for some reason, somebody told him, hey, that old rundown church is for sale. He went over. Second he saw it, he goes, I'll take it.
Hmm.
He bought the church and turned it into a hunt camp. Hmm. And it's in the woods up north, and it's weathered wood, and they took the pews out and made it a living area with the living room and put a little bar in the corner, and then they put some bunks up top where the, you know, it's small. It was.
Can you still tell it's a church?
You can, yeah.
Do you feel different walking into it?
Well, there's, you know, a Budweiser sign above the door. Okay. It's the shape of a little old tiny church that probably could hold on a Sunday morning 50 people, mm, packed into there.
Mm. Does it have the bell? Were you no bell. Pulling on it with the rope?
There was no bell. No. It's things have grown up.
You dip into holy water before you go hunting?
Yeah, and those guys, They can find a rough grouse and a woodcock like few that I have ever hunted with. And so they've got this little family up there in the woods. They all gather around bird camp in this old church. So that's a story that I think is going to be pretty cool. And I don't know if you remember last fall, but the Northern Lights were just
unbelievable.
And I went from an island up in Ontario watching the Northern Lights every night race above us to this church in northern Minnesota. And literally everywhere you look, the sky is just dancing at night. And it was, I don't even know how to describe it. I mean, you guys saw some of it, right?
Yep.
It was so vivid that even our cameras are just watching these, you know, so some of that natural beauty, I think, is going to be in this season as well.
So I'm curious, you know, all of us around this table grew up rough grouse hunting. We live in what I call the rough grouse capital of the world. It could be Michigan. It could be Wisconsin. Who the hell knows? But Minnesota, there are a lot of birds in Minnesota. This particular one is north of the border up in Ontario. So week two. You guys, Sunset Island Grouse Camp, you're going to join two buddies for a cast and blast adventure in pursuit of grouse, waterfowl, and walleyes on the islands of Lake of the Woods. I'm curious, when I go up there, I go up and do an ice fishing trip every year up in the northwest angle, and when I look at some of the islands up there, not a lot of it seems like it's managed or there's cuts. Is that what you find when you go up there? But there's just so much habitat that the birds just coexist without that cutting.
It's as remote and raw as it could possibly get. You're talking burns, fires that can create new habitat, but they're not managed. We found one island that had what I think in the winter is just a snowmobile path, because there were some signs that signaled the snowmobile path, because there was a cabin on one island, you know, a distant island, and I think to get to it there was some current areas that they didn't want to go on ice, so that was as close as we found to a walking trail. But I have been up there before, and to me, you know, we want to go on these real adventures. Like, that's real. We pulled a boat up to an island, and until you're walking on it, you really don't know what's going to happen.
That's pretty cool.
And I think that's part of the mystery that I enjoy. You know, I love seeing a bunch of birds get up everywhere, but we were hopeful based on the amount of rough grouse in Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, you know, going into the hatch last summer. Obviously we got heavy rains in northern Minnesota that washed out a lot going into 2024 fall season. Well, we didn't know what was going to happen on the islands, and unfortunately they got washed out too. But if you walk hard enough and you trust your dogs, you just have to bushwhack to get to them. And so it is something that our cameraman hated to put lightly, because trying to get through that stuff, it was as much of a jungle as I've ever walked through.
Have you hunted in the Boundary Waters?
No.
Okay.
I've not. But that's a similar thing. When you're portaging, you know, I'm going up in 7 days, actually, with my boys. And you hear the grouse. You see the grouse. You've hunted up there. And it's awesome, right?
It's the thickest stuff in the world to try to penetrate outside of the portages because of the rock and the blowdown. I mean, it is, it's the worst hunting there is.
That's a great way to describe it.
It just is so difficult.
But I think, too, at the same time, you remember those terrible moments. They really stand out.
No doubt.
And so,
and you savor the birds that you get in that stuff, that tough stuff.
Totally. But you're also on one of, if not the greatest walleye fisheries in North America.
On Lake of the Woods.
Yep. And agreed. So we stayed at this outpost camp on an island, Sunset Channel Island Outpost is what it's called. And there's nobody there cooking for us or anything like that. We do have power on the island, but there's not another soul as far as you can see. Every once in a while, a boat will drive by. But come October, most of the anglers have gone home. So, yeah, we had a surf and turf. shore lunch with fresh walleye. I mean, you could stand on the rock on the point of the island.
And they're just putting on a feed bag.
And you cast out and you catch walleyes and smallmouth bass. That's, right?
Yeah, I love that lake.
And then it's one of the most underrated waterfowl hunting lakes as well. That's so cool. You find a bay with rice and the ducks just come pouring in. Mm. And so, yeah, we did it all. And so, yeah, the cover and the grouse numbers weren't as high as we wanted, but we still got grouse. Mm. And we also watched the sunrise from the mucky marsh and ducks pouring in left, right, and, you know, just catching as many walleyes. So I think if you like a real raw good adventure, that's what that is.
Yeah, this is going to for sure be the podcast with the most references to raw.
Raw and real.
As you're talking about grouse hunting on an island, my mind keeps going back to this idea that when you teach new people how to rough grouse hunt, one of the hardest things is making sure they don't get lost. I'm recognizing that in the time of Onyx and cell phones and GPS, that's become a little easier. But I always, you know, people that didn't grow up in the woods get turned around super easy in the woods as opposed to being able to look over the horizon. And I think about, like, when I take a person grouse hunting, it's like I try to create natural boundaries, whether that's roads, streams, like, or a pasture, like, box them in is the way I refer to it, right? Yep. Like, okay, just walk this way. And if you lose your way... Right, like, or if we get separated somehow, just get to the open, whatever the open is, a stream, a road, and wait for me.
Versus giving them a direction, like, walk north.
Right, like,
where the hell's that?
Yeah. And, you know, 'cause everybody's got a little bit different level of skill when it comes to orienteering, right?
Yeah.
But I was thinking about it, you know, this, let's drop somebody off on an island.
We stayed together. That's the only real.
How big are these islands?
Some are huge.
Yeah, I imagine.
Some are really big and some are small because we're trying to figure out where are these birds. See, we're a couple miles in, and a couple miles on some of that bushwhacking is hours and hours.
So you're saying this box somebody in on an island might not be the right.
They could still be up there.
And not to mention, too, like... I've really loved a lot of the kind of surf and turf episodes you guys have done over the years. There was one in South Dakota that was really cool on the Missouri River. But, like, I don't think people understand the size of a place like Lake of the Woods in late October or early October, whenever it was. And, like, you get any wind on that lake and, like, even trying to get to some of those spots.
Mm. That's part of what...
It's an adventure with a capital A.
So we had... This doesn't really make the show because we had to package up the gear to get in. But when we got there, it was unbelievable winds that were blowing. And the resort owner that was bringing all of their crew off of the main lake from one of their island resorts, we were going to this outpost camp, the small one. They actually capsized a boat up there. And he goes, we've been running this resort for like 30 years. Or 40 years now, and we have never had that kind of winds.
Wow.
And so they ended up having, they capsized the boat, they had to pull in with their big barge on an island and stay until they had to do an overnight there.
Calm down.
When we got to our dock, we tied up, and it's a floating dock that comes off of these big boulders on the island. The direction of the wind, it actually, the force of the wind pushing our boats that were tied to the dock rip the dock off. So we caught it as it was ripping off of the island. Mm. And what I ended up doing was I took my boat and I have enough rope that there was a giant tree up on shore. So we threw it. Ben Bredigan's with me. He's in the water chest deep, unfortunately.
Oh, that time of year?
Yes. So we hook up the boat to the clip on the front, to the rope, tied around this big tree, and then the two hooks on the back that you strap your boat down to, we tied that to the dock.
Hmm.
That's what kept the dock from blowing off, because then it would have gone, you know, about a mile to the next shoreline, because that particular part of the lake was pretty open. But there was nobody else around, so it was dark, pitch dark, and we saved the dock, and I have photos of it tied up, holding it, and the dock completely ripped off of the island. So those are things that you don't necessarily see, because while we're doing that, we're not rolling on it. We're just trying to save the...
I was going
to
say, does that make the episode?
No, I wish it would.
That's pretty cool.
But it was dark, and we needed all hands available. It was just four of us three and then the cameraman, and we're like, you need to be here. I'm throwing you the rope when we get here, and you're going to tie it up, and we're going to... Yeah, and so some of those things are just part of a good adventure. Yeah. We'll remember all that, you know, and a lot of it we tried to capture, but the winds and the weather... Yeah, it's real.
If you make it the first mile without dying, that should be a pretty good trip.
You know? You would think so. And we had to deal with it the entire time up there, which definitely threw a wrench into the plans that we had made.
Yeah, those are things as part of the show that you just don't see. But yeah, there's just so many cool episodes this year, and just a lot of different places where you guys are chasing all sorts of different birds. Indiana pheasants and quail, Oklahoma bobwhites.
That was yours, Jared. Yeah. And you didn't, make it with us.
I didn't come because of tearing the ACL. Mm. I just wasn't in.
Are you going to be in game shape for this season?
Yes.
Have you been working out?
Yes.
It's yours. Is that even
a question? Can't you tell? I'm sitting right next to you. No, I'll be good to go. I'm excited to get back and actually do a lot of hunting this week.
Now, all the athletes on all this – the pro sports teams, when they get asked about their recovery, they always say 110%. They're better than they were pre-surgery. So are you 110% hunter this year? Better than ever?
I'm 118.
118%. So I'm not going to be able to keep up with them?
I'm 85% right now after getting surgery in December.
Okay.
So about five months.
So you got a couple more before season starts. You're going
to
be?
Yeah, I'll be good to go.
Where you want to be?
I'll be good to go.
He just put in for a darkness retreat on his PTO too, so I'm not sure what that means to his.
I was invited by Aaron Rodgers too. Yeah.
So you mentioned right before Oklahoma, you mentioned Indiana, and that was on my list to ask you about because, you know.
You don't think about Indiana often, do you?
Well, it's also... You know, you're putting a television show together to inspire people and create some action and, you know, sell sponsorships around. You want to make sure that there is action, that there is things to show. Indiana, for a lot of people, would be like, are we sure we're going to see? And what was your experience there?
I trusted Jared that there were going to be birds there.
And I trusted Josh, our regional rep down there at the time. Yeah. But yeah, I think that was a pretty cool story. That came together from a former regional rep that we had there, Josh Bleicher, and a chapter that's just really active, doing a lot of private and public lands management out there as part of their Pheasants Forever chapter. Well, you go ahead. You went out there and hunted with the group, and I remember – I was sitting by my phone waiting for a text message after I sent one like, hey, I know you're out there this week. How's it going?
Yeah, it is interesting that there are certain soil types, and this is stuff that you learn when you're in different places, that just grow birds. Mm. If they have the right grass, the right habitat, the right food, they can explode. And this particular part of Indiana proved it.
Mm.
So the work that they have done there, there's a lot of pheasants, wild birds, and it just goes to show that, again, you just have to give them a place to live, and that's the hard thing, is that it's heavy farm country, and talking with people there, you know, the difference in just trimming the trees along a fence line versus just taking the trees out so that the trees' branches aren't clipping their tractor and their combine as they go by is a covey of quail. That's what that equates to. That equates to a brood of pheasants giving by not just removing that entire fence line and the brush that sticks out of it, you give them a place and they don't need much. But that's a real struggle, is farming, literally taking that fence row out and farming up to it on both sides from both farmers. So those that can leave, we're not talking a lot. I mean, we walked some strips that were probably, I don't know, I mean, let's say 20 yards wide, where they would just leave them in habitat strips around the egg fields. You're talking a section, and there was probably 60 birds in that section.
Wow.
You know, and so if you do that multiple times, it adds up pretty quickly. Some areas they had big CRP fields in, and those had hundreds of birds.
Wow.
You know, and you think you were somewhere besides Indiana. So that goes back to the efforts that were put in there by some very, very hardcore, awesome conservationists. And it's cool to go and see that. And also hear from other landowners that are looking at it and saying, that's all you got to do? That's not bad.
That's a really important story to tell.
Yeah.
Right? And a little bit of opportunity for the birds.
A little bit.
Optimism.
Yep, totally.
It creates the optimism, which generates the opportunity.
And that's bobwhite country, too. Mm-hmm. So we not only saw a lot of pheasants, we saw pretty decent-sized coveys of bobwhites. Now, they did throw us a few curveballs and places we were hoping to see them, we didn't necessarily. In places we weren't ready, we saw them. So
that's how it goes.
It's how it goes, and that's how it should go, right? Mm-hmm. Oklahoma was unbelievable. There are certain parts of the country last year that had an amazing quail hatch. And prior to that adventure, my best bobwhite quail hunt, wild birds, was in Oklahoma many years ago. And then this one raised the bar on it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I'm really optimistic, as I'm sure, Jared, you probably are too. You like to get in a few quail hunts. Mm-hmm. Anybody listening would want more quail on the ground. And last year we had a nice rebound. Weather, water, moisture. I mean,
yep.
When it comes together, it is something.
Could be interesting to see what happens down in some of those southern quail areas this year.
Well, so you brought me exactly where I want to go. You know, we've talked a lot about this current season of the flush. What's on the horizon that you're going to film this fall, the fall of 2025? And, you know, here's your opportunity to send a message out there to the listening audience of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever folks. What's missing that you're on the hunt for?
Yeah, I think we're always looking for our next adventure. I always say that because we really, truly are. I keep a folder with story ideas for future hunts. The problem we run into is I might get 10 ideas or 20 ideas for this hunt, which is in mid-October, prime time, or early November, and I can only be in one place at one time, and our staff are only able to do so much during the prime time. So this other hunt gets tabled, and then we might do it next year. It still could be a good idea. A lot of it, I think, will be determined based on, gosh, what we learn about this hatch.
Sure.
You know, what happens throughout the summer months. We try to have a variety of different birds, different species, different places. And we really do like to go out and film the stories with people that are listening right now, members of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever. That's our audience, right? And so we're sharing your stories, and we get a lot of invites to do that, and we appreciate those, and that's really the mission that we want to share. And so if people have those ideas for us or adventures, cool adventures to go on, they can just reach out to us at The Flush. They can send a message through Pheasants Forever site. I know Jared forwards them on too.
And yep.
Any ideas that might come up, please send them on over, because That's really the essence of our show.
So as simple as contact@pheasantsforever.org or contact@quailforever.org.
Yep.
Then it hits Jared's inbox and then sends him along direct to Travis.
Yeah. Otherwise on our theflush.tv or The Flush on our social channels too, it eventually works its way over to me. And some people just find me on social as well and send me messages. They're like, this would be awesome, or you got to meet this guy. Like, I had a listener reach out because his uncle is a loyal podcast listener. He's blind. He's been blind for most of his life. He was shot on a dove hunt in the eyes and lost vision in both eyes as a kid, but he still goes hunting today as a blind man. He's not shooting his gun, but he's doing everything else. His hand is on his nephew's shoulder as they're watching. He's training his own dog. His own dog is out there. He holds the birds as they come back. This guy's from Texas, and he hunts all over the country. and I want to hunt with him. That's the kind of story where you just, you kind of
will
have
that
to
be
see
an episode
it.
Next year or we, TBD? We're
TBD, but I want to. And his bucket list item after listening to all these conversations that us Northerners have had is to get a grouse, a rough grouse. So I'm thinking, I'm going to take a blind man into the woods. But it does sound like something that would be really incredible to achieve for this man.
Yeah.
If I can pull
and
it
that
off.
That podcast you did with him was 3-4 months ago?
I want to say, like, yeah, March, it was in the, yeah, something? That sounds about right. It was pre-Pheasant Fest, if I remember right.
Oh, okay, so it was maybe January, February.
Yeah.
A little while ago now.
Yep, I think so. It blends together.
Yeah, it does. Does.
We're, every week.
So, like you mentioned, you get a proliferation of ideas October, November. So if listeners have something that's September or January,
yeah,
those are cherries for you.
Yeah, it really helps to be able to start our hunting season. I'm on the road filming September, and then we've got October, November, December, January, and even some places February. Mm-hmm. Some places are still open. So, yeah, the hunting season goes really fast, and being able to hunt different areas different times of the year helps to spread things out. But certainly if you got a great story for November,
right,
yeah, send it on over too. It might just be something that we think is awesome and we haven't done yet. That's the thing where, it, just like this show, Bob, I mean, every week you have to produce another episode, right? And at some point you're thinking, what haven't I done yet? And then an idea clicks and you go with it. And sometimes that's just how the TV stuff works too. And you say, yeah, that does sound great. If you've got a young kid or a wife or I don't know. I mean, it's just you never know how the story is going to go. But characters are great. They just make for a lot of fun for viewers to watch. And hopefully when it's all said and done, you get done watching it and you say, I want to do that. I want to bring my kids with. I want to take my wife along. I want to bring my dad. I want to bring my mom or whatever it might be and try that too.
Outside of, outside of the ideas and the stories that you tell on the flush, I just want to give kudos to the show. Season 14, we talked about a little bit about the cinematic elements of it early on. And I just think trying to put all that together for a TV show, you typically bring one camera guy with you, and trying to capture all that. I just got to think that birds have to be one of the hardest things to try to get, especially if it's in a, whether it's on the prairie or in the forest, for any of the forest grouse species. But, you know, putting that all together and getting it on film, you guys have just done a really tremendous job. And I don't know. I look forward to, outside of being in the show a couple times, which I've really appreciated, and be able to tell the story of, you know, our organization and our members and partners and landowners. Just being able to watch it every week and be like, man, that's a bucket list hunt that I want to do sometime. I think is really unique.
I appreciate you saying that. I tell our team all the time how much feedback we get, and they're the ones sitting there right now editing as we speak here, sitting in a room just yakking it up. They're out there working on putting that script together and making it look as beautiful as possible. So I always want to tell them, your work is enjoyed by a lot of people. A lot of people.
Remind folks if they want to go back and watch old episodes where they can find all those.
Yeah, you can go to YouTube and then just search The Flush TV, and you'll see our logo, and we have a channel. And then we break it down by season. And you can go back and watch up to 7, 8, 9, maybe 10 years ago at this point.
Is there, if you were going to point to one, I know this is a tough question, but point to one that would give them a flavor of what you want them to see. Is there one episode that stands out?
No, there's not. Because they're all different in their own ways. I think, you know, the ptarmigan hunt in Alaska showed just real cool landscape. Just a place that probably only sees a couple human beings every year, or maybe not even that many. And birds that are in just one of the most unbelievable settings of all time. And that adventure is available on public land. You know, anybody can go do it. And so to me, that shows a really cool adventure that might be, that was on the top of my bucket list. Mm. You and I, Bob, talked about that for years, mm-hmm. and to be able to experience it, I am forever grateful for it. But also, some of my favorites are really where I grew up hunting. Mm. I still love it. I still love going to North Dakota out there in the prairie. It's been a place that I started going to back in high school when I first started bird hunting with my buddies. And I was able to take my son there. And that, to me, is one of the most really special hunts that I've had. Again, with my wife. To this day at Pheasant Fest, every year, that is still the most talked about episode that I've ever produced was with my wife. And then now this past year was with my son. They're two separate hunts, mm-hmm. years apart. But it just, it must have hit home in a way that I think is important for us to hit. And I think I'll look back at those episodes years and years from now and be like, gosh, time goes really fast. I'm glad that we captured that.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that I had that experience with my family.
Speaking of family, you can look for the entire Frank family, episode 6 of the season. So week 6 coming up of this year on the Flush. You can find it on Outdoor Channel. I'll remind you, times Mondays, 2:30, and these are all Eastern, Mondays at 2:30, Tuesdays at 12:30 p.m., Thursdays at 8:30 a.m., prime time, Saturdays at 12:30 p.m., and then Sundays for the early risers at 6:30 a.m. Lots of opportunities to watch The Flush on Outdoor Channel. From July to December, and then you can stream it after that on YouTube. Thanks for coming this way.
I love being able to sit down and have these conversations with you guys, and I really appreciate the partnership that we have with Pheasants Forever, because that, to me, that's your mission. It's our mission, yeah. too.
We 20 share, years, man.
We share the same mission. We have since I started producing this show, and for me to meet a lot of our members out there in the field and walk a field with them to find out what they really care about. It's pretty special thing.
Yeah, and you see all sorts of people at Pheasant Fest coming up and saying hello.
So do you. And whenever I have a Pheasant Forever hat or something on, Ron Mothers and I were joking about this the other day. Do you know Bob St. Pierre? I sure do.
Pheasant Bob.
Oh, Pheasant Bob. Yes.
That's a power at K fan in the Twin Cities.
Sure is.
Yeah, that's putting my name in front of a lot of people on Saturday morning. Mm-hmm.
You live and breathe the mission, and it's a testament to what you do, Bob. Yeah, so thank you.
Jared, thanks for joining me. You want to hand me your punch card?
Sure. Here you go. Thanks, guys. It was a fun conversation, and it's got me revved up for fall to get back after it this year, and I'm really looking forward to getting out on the prairie and in the woods and on the water with like-minded individuals and my family as well. So
very cool.
Right on. All right, folks. If you have a story idea that you think is just made for television, it could even be a 90s sitcom, send Jared an email, contact@pheasantsforever.org or contact@quailforever.org, and we'll make sure we get it into Travis Frank's hands. Again, thank you so much to Scott Franzen, Travis Frank, and the entire Ron Chair Productions crew for being our partners for 2 decades and bringing The Flush to all of you. Hopefully check out season 14, the 2025 season on Outdoor Channel, coming your way right now. Thanks for listening, folks. I'm Bob St. Pierre, reminding you to always follow the dog. Something good will rise. Thanks for listening.